choosinghats.com, dedicated to the explanation and demonstration of presuppositional apologetics in defense of the Christian faith for the glory of God.
Welcome to Practice Presupp. This is Chris Bolt. As promised, we're going to go ahead and take a look at the discussion which happened between the three Pauls of the Skepticule Extra podcast. This is at www.skepticule, spelled S-K-E-P-T-I-C-U-L-E, .co.uk. Again, that's Skepticule, that's S-K-E-P-T-I-C-U-L-E, .co.uk. There's the website for the Skepticule broadcast or podcast or whatever we want to call it. I wonder why it's spelled with a K there if they're British. I guess since it's not really a real word, they've changed that around. But anyway, we're going to be taking a look at the discussion that happened there between the three Pauls who are on the show, one of which is Paul Baird. This is the gentleman I was supposed to be debating in late August, and he backed out on me. And then Paul Thompson goes by the name Sinbad, and then Paul S. Jenkins. These are the three Pauls of the Skepticule podcast, and they have Eric Hovind and Sytim Brugenkate on this podcast. It's about an hour long, so it's going to take quite a while for us to get through it. The previous discussion that I commented on, the Sheever discussion with Tim Brugenkate, was roughly an hour as well, but I'm not going to be able to put the podcast out quite as quickly for this review here. But let's go ahead and get started.
Hi, this is Paul. Welcome to the Skepticule Record. About half an hour into our recording of Skepticule Extra number 9 with Paul Baird, Paul Thompson, a.k.a. Sinbad, and myself, Paul S. Jenkins, on Monday the 11th of July 2011, and due out shortly, Paul Baird invited Eric Hovind of Creation Science Evangelism into the conversation. About 15 minutes later, we were joined by Sytim Brugenkate of Sinner Ministries. This is the recording of that conversation, unedited, apart from a Skype dropout at about 43 minutes.
Hey, Paul, yeah, this is
Eric.
I just jumped on, yeah.
Hi, yeah.
Hey.
Hi, yeah.
Yeah, I was just about to instant message you to find out. I just went back and listened to the Oklahoma podcast that you had discussed about. And I'm for the life of me trying to see from your perspective why you would take such an offense to pointing out what I felt like was an interesting inconsistency. Perhaps I came across in totally the wrong way, and that was not my desire at all. And if it came across personally offensive to you as an individual, man, I owe you an apology. My desire was to speak strictly about the argument and the things that were said.
So Eric Hovind has been invited to this Skype conversation with the other Pauls, apparently, and he's been invited by Paul Baird. And really, this is a sort of ambush here, is what it comes across as. Eric's been invited into this Skype discussion, which actually happens to be on a podcast. Now, he does willingly do this, so it's not like, you know, there's anything really unfair going on here. He was just invited, and then it was explained to him that this was a podcast, and he accepted and continued with the discussion. So, anyway, they are referring back to the so-called third debate between Sytim Brugenkate and Paul Baird. There is a transcript of that debate. I don't know if it's full or not, up on Paul Baird's website. As far as the actual audio from the debate, I believe it's going to be released with those two first debates from the Unbelievable Radio program with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio. I think that all three debates will be released together. I'm not sure if there's going to be a cost on those or not. I think that there might be. But I'll have to look at proofthatgodexists.org afterward to see if there's anything up about that just yet. But if not, Cy may shoot me an email or something and let me know for certain what is actually going on there. But anyway, so Eric has apparently upset Paul Baird in some way, and he's addressing that right away, bringing it up with Paul to get that straight. And so that's where we pick up the conversation here. And by the way, there is a lot of, for lack of a better term, there's a lot of drama concerning all of the things that are going on up to this point. And I'm just going to leave it in there and let it play. It'll keep things lively and entertaining. Unlike me, I am neither lively nor entertaining. Here we go.
Okay. Let me first bring you up to speed. We're actually recording a podcast called Skeptical Extra, which is we're going to put on. So I don't know if you want to stay on or do you want to give me a call later?
Okay. It's somebody invited me into this, so I'm not sure.
That was me. That was me.
Okay.
That's just, you know. Okay. Where we are with that is the criticisms that you were making were entirely valid. Okay, they were entirely valid based on the content of the first debate. So
okay.
my hands are to that. But as I said to you during our discussions before the recording of the third debate, I very much went into that first debate with about 3 weeks' notice.
Right.
My original debate was going to be against Amy or Ewing on the historicity of, I think, the nativity. So when I was doing that first debate, I was very much responding intuitively. And I've said this before. I've said this also in the second debate. So your criticisms are perfectly valid based simply on the content of that first debate. They're not valid when you then take into account what was said in the second debate and also in the third debate. And that was what was annoying me. I think that
okay.
if you're just going to take the first debate and say, okay, that's all that happened, then your comments are fair. But two other debates have happened since then, and particularly the second debate, where I said, okay, I was reacting intuitively. I've had a bit more time to think about things like the laws of logic and where all of that comes from. And particularly when you were giving that example or you were quoting what Cy was saying to me, where he was trying to demonstrate that I'd managed to enter into a self-contradiction, whether I said yes or whether I said no. Now, when I was in the second debate and also in the third debate, I did point out that there are circumstances in paraconsistent logic and also in diethylism where it is possible that the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold, in which case the law of non-contradiction isn't absolute, but in most circumstances it does hold. Now, I'm quite happy with that, but that sort of didn't really come across. And Cy's aware of it, and it's explicitly stated in the second debate, which is why...
Dialetheism is a view which is quite old. It was addressed by Aristotle, even though it did not go by that name back then. It's been recently popularized by a logician named Graham Priest, and you can research more about that on your own. I don't care to get into it a whole lot more. Basically, the view holds that true contradictions are possible, or even in some instances, true contradictions are actual. There are various metaphysical or states of affairs that they believe are simply inconsistent with the application of the principle of non-contradiction, or that there are certain propositions that are inconsistent with it in some sense. So, for example, a famous example is the so-called liar paradox, and the liar paradox can be explained as follows. Consider proposition X, and proposition X states the following. Proposition X is false. So what we have here is a bit of a problem, because if we say that proposition X is true, then we are bound to what proposition X states about proposition X, namely that proposition X is false. So if proposition X is true, then it is false. And if proposition X is false, then what proposition X states about itself is actually true. it is false. And so we have a proposition, X, which appears to be both true and false at the same time in the same respect. Now, there are different ways to respond to something like the liar paradox and the apparent problem there, other than by embracing Grand Priest's approach to this entire topic. There is, for example, a Percian account of what propositions are actually doing, that truth is implied by a proposition, any proposition. Or there are solutions involving appealing to a second-order language to talk about the first-order language that's exemplified in something like a proposition X, as noted in the previous example. So there are different ways to attempt to explain some of these apparent true contradictions. Also, there are some different reasons for actually objecting to or rejecting a dialetheist view of truth, or a dialetheist view of logic, or whatever you want to say there. For example, you could argue by the principle of explosion that anything follows from a contradiction, from a true contradiction. So you begin that proof. There's actually a formal proof that can be written out for this, where you begin the proof by affirming an actual contradiction as true, and then from the initial premise of the argument, you derive a conclusion that is deliberately absurd. So you could say that Paul Baird actually is a bird, something like that. And there's no problem because you've affirmed the true contradiction there. Now, what these people in view here will do is appeal to paraconsistent logic to try to get around a problem like that. So that's a very, very brief overview of all this. It's all very fun and interesting stuff. I would encourage you to go and read about it. Things are not always as simple as people make them out to be. But I certainly don't think that appealing to dialetheism or paraconsistent logic in this instance is going to help Paul Baird out at all. And so let's continue so that we can see what exactly he tries to do by simply just citing the fact that there are philosophers who argue this.
My problem, Paul, is that even in the third debate, you continue to deny certain laws. So to say that, you know, I accept
that... Hang on a second. I'll call up. Let me just get hold of the transcript of the third debate, because I've got that. Whereabouts are you saying that I did that?
Well, throughout the entire thing, as he asked you questions in his first 15 minutes of questioning you, and by the way, when we release this, our goal is to release all three together, so people will see the progression. And I understand you saying you've moved from a soft atheist to a hard atheist. Yeah. That's a point that I wanted to take into consideration and ask why. And we do that later in a show afterwards when we're critiquing the debate, ask the question, why is it that you've moved from a soft atheist to a hard atheist?
I was really looking forward to sinking my teeth into Paul Baird's hard atheism, but did not get that opportunity because he backed out of a debate with me. I don't believe that hard atheism can even close to be defended, especially by Paul Baird. So I would love to see his reasons and defense for that position. But anyway.
And then the other thing is how you continued to deny absolute laws of logic, absolute, you know, thinking, absolute morality. There were several things that, you know, you assumed, but then you denied.
Whereabouts? Because I've got the transcript in front of me, and I'm looking at the first 15 minutes block. Whereabouts have I done that?
I don't have the pleasure of having a transcript in front of me, but I'd be more than happy to look through it. I've just watched the debate a couple times since then via video.
My understanding is that wherever I've engaged in a query, just trying to see.
I would ask you now, do you hold to the laws of logic as absolute?
Which ones?
Okay, the law of
I've already explained the law of non-contradiction. I've given you paraconsistent logic and diethylism, which provide exceptions to the concept that they can be absolute.
Okay, but so a question here would be, do you hold to the law of non-contradiction or not? And he believes, apparently, he affirms this position that there can be, so it's possible, or even that there actually are, so it's actual, such things as true contradictions. And this, he says, militates against the view that there are such things as absolute laws of logic, like the law of non-contradiction. Now, I don't know how Cy and Eric are going to argue their point here. Paul might still want to say that there are absolute laws of logic in certain instances, since he believes that these are apparently only exceptions to the rule. Again, if we wanted to get into a debate over the whole absolute characteristic of logic, whether or not it is there or not, whether or not logic is absolute, whether or not particular laws are absolute, and all of this sort of thing, we would dig deeply into the dialetheism and paraconsistent logic and whatnot. It's a minority position. It's not held by many people for a good reason, I think. And, we would have to have a debate over that. But I would just approach this and say, look, I don't care. I'm not here to debate about the laws of logic and whether or not they're absolute. I understand that there are unbelievers who do not believe that the laws of logic are absolute. In fact, Justin Schieber, if you listen to the previous series of podcasts concerning his discussion with Cy, he says some really strange things about logic and really ends up just throwing logic out of the window. The same thing happens with Paul in some of his debates. I think in the very first debate that he had with Cy, he's just very dismissive of logic. So I understand that unbelievers have these different views about logic, and many of them will not want to say something like the laws of logic are absolute. That's fine. What we want to do is internally critique the unbeliever's position and ask, okay, given what you've said concerning logic, now, can you even make a rational case here at all? And this is another potential problem with a dialetheist stance, is whether or not we are rational to hold to something. In any event, we should take what Paul actually says, professes, and also what he practices concerning logic, and run that through the ringer.
Now, you can go and look those up. Those concepts are in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. What I'm asking, but basically, you're saying, okay, there are times when the law of non-contradiction does not apply.
Yeah, they may only be rare. They may only be kind of like a little speck.
How do we know when they apply and when they don't apply? How do we know they can't apply right now to this conversation? And I can say exactly what Cy said in the first debate and say, oh, so you do believe in the law of non-contradiction? Absolutely.
Good. So I think that's a fair question from Eric there to Paul, because Eric is looking at the worldview that Paul is ascribing to here. Paul has just affirmed dialetheism, which he would really have to be ready to defend, especially if he were ever to debate me, but that apparently is not going to happen. Anyway, after reading the Stanford Encyclopedia article on that on the internet, which, by the way, is just a lot of internet atheists, I've noticed, appeal to this source. Really, though, I have a hard time saying much bad about it. It's a good introductory level site to philosophical topics. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, I believe that's the correct name, the correct order of the words of the name. Give it a Google and give it a read and learn some things, but it's not the same thing as studying a topic in depth when you go and read an article, especially about something like this, on that website. It's especially not enough, I don't think, to then change your position and accept something as radical as Graham Priest's view. This is a problem, though, a potential problem with that view. that Eric is driving at here. How do we know when there are true contradictions and when there are not, and all of those? Perhaps this, right now, this discussion, Eric says, between Paul and Eric, is an instance of such contradictions being true, or of such a contradiction being true. And then, of course, we still have the principle of explosion lingering in the background. But anyway, let's see how Paul answers this question that Eric has asked.
I can accept the law of non-contradiction 99.9999% of the time.
Okay, but he hasn't answered the question. How does he know when those times are and when those times are not?
But I'm also aware that there is that tiny, tiny, tiny little fraction of the time where it doesn't, and that's where diethylism and paraconsistent logic comes in. And you only need that little bit, and it's not absolute.
Well, then I would say this is one of those, and you do believe it. This is one of those 0.0001% of the time, and you actually do believe it.
No, it would be the 0.0001 would be the times when the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold.
Right,
and I'm 99.99% of the time, I do. And right now is one of those times. I'm quite happy to say right now, Eric, you and I, we agree there is a law of non-contradiction.
Okay, and how do you account for that law of non-contradiction? That's what Cy has been driving at since debate one. And Paul really has not given a good answer. Just to throw out, oh, there's paraconsistent logic and these types of things, that doesn't answer the question at all. All he's doing is he's just citing the position. He's not explaining it. He's not explaining how he holds it. He's not explaining how he answers the objections to it. He's referenced the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy online. This is hardly a scholarly resource for this type of minority, apparently absurd position. And yes, there are philosophers of logic who would believe that it is a little bit off the wall. Of course, in philosophy, this is the sort of thing that we do all the time. But anyway, let's continue.
Okay, and if we really agreed on that, then we would go straight into how do we account for that. However, I could easily, in an argument, if I was arguing logically with you, I would say, okay, how do you know this isn't one of the 0.0001% of the time?
I think that Eric has nailed it there. I think he's done a really good job of asking Paul a question here. First of all, how do we account for that 99 point whatever percent? How in the world do we get those percentages anyway? But even if setting that question aside, how we account for those times, which is really what I would also be after that and asking Paul that, because this is his view of logic. We're doing an internal critique here. I don't care whether or not Paul holds that the laws of logic are absolute. I want to know how Paul would defend his use of logic, and especially the law of non-contradiction, in these 99 point whatever percent times that he says that it holds. And then the other question then, setting that aside, is how does he know when it does hold and does not hold? These are both valid questions. I want to hear answers from Paul.
Yeah, I mean, you see the flaw in logic. You see the problem that we have here.
No.
Okay,
so perhaps there hasn't been a flaw demonstrated clearly enough for Paul yet, but there's certainly been some good questions asked of Paul, and he has not answered. So if he can't even answer these questions, then how are we going to demonstrate for him the flaws? And if he doesn't want to see any of these things demonstrated, if he just wants to believe that there aren't any such flaws, but he's going to close his eyes, bury his head in the sand, and stay away from him. I mean, how is that being honest with respect to the view that he holds here, view like this?
Okay, so I'm going to say, hey, Paul, this is actually one of those 0.001% of the time. If you disagree with me, well, that's fine, because this is one of those times, and so we're both right. Are we both right here or no?
So what Eric is doing here is performing a reductio ad absurdum on Paul's view. Now, it may or may not hold. We need to see, does Paul have a defense for this? Eric is claiming this is one of those times that the law of non-contradiction does not hold. So, for example, both of them can be right, or God might exist and not exist, something like that. So what is Paul going to respond with?
You would need to justify it being one of those times.
I don't think so. I think that the mere possibility that it could be one of those times, his assertion that it could be one of those times, is enough to warrant Eric's dilemma here. And Paul has already granted that it is at least possible that in this instance there is a true contradiction or true contradictions. Paul has already granted that that is possible per his position. So then Eric does not have to offer any evidence for that position of Paul's. Paul has already conceded it. That's what we're working off of. So is it actual or not? Well, does Eric need to provide any evidence that it is? Paul is saying that Eric does need to provide that evidence. Eric is saying that Paul needs to provide the evidence against it being one of those instances. What's the problem here? Well, I think that the problem goes back to Eric's question. You see, there has not been given any program for determining what counts as evidence for and against there being an actual true contradiction in Paul's worldview. If Paul is going to hold to this position, then Paul needs to be able to defend this position. He needs to defend it when he's called upon to do so, especially in an apologetic encounter, especially in the context of a debate or a discussion of this nature. Okay, Eric is asking him essentially what we're getting to every time that Paul is talking about how Eric needs to provide the evidence for this being an actual contradiction or actual true contradiction, and then vice versa.
No, not according to your worldview. You don't.
Not at all. If it's holding true for 99.999% of the time, I think I'm quite well justified to say that this is one of those occasions where the law of non-contradiction does hold.
Okay. That's a very interesting response because, you see, in those instances where he says that there are such things as true contradictions, he could apply the same argument and come to the same conclusion. You see, let's suppose that the liar paradox really is a true contradiction. In that instance, someone could present the liar paradox to Paul and say, now, is this an instance of an actual true contradiction? And Paul might respond and say, well, no, you'd have to justify this being one of those instances of a true contradiction. And, of course, we might ask, well, how would you ever justify that? What type of evidence would you accept? And he would probably dodge the question as he's done here with Eric. But Paul's response to the question of how he knows whether or not this is one of those instances or not might be something to the effect of what he just said. He might say, in the instance of the liar paradox, which Paul, according to the Dialetheus stance, would accept as an actual true contradiction, Paul would respond to that instance, and he would say something like what he just offered. He would say, well, given that 99.9% of the time the law of non-contradiction actually does hold, which, by the way, he hasn't justified that claim or those statistics yet, that alleged probability at all. It's just a subjective-sounding number that he's thrown out there to warrant the things that he's saying, or to attempt to warrant the things he's saying or make them sound better. Anyway, you see, his argument applies there as well. Well, given that 99.9% of the time it does hold, I think that I'm very well justified in holding that this is one of those instances as well. But you see, that undercuts the whole program, because he can do that in the case of any alleged true contradiction. Paul doesn't have an answer here for Eric. How is it, Paul, that you know that this discussion here, or some of the claims that are being made here, are not instances of true contradictions? These are the types of questions and problems that this position leads us into.
ChoosingHats.com, dedicated to the explanation and demonstration of presuppositional apologetics in defense of the Christian faith for the glory of God.